a podcast called The Battle for African Culture, the space where we challenge dominant narratives and imagine just sustainable futures, especially when it comes to food and farming in Africa. Today's conversation dives into one of the most urgent and overlooked issues shaping our food systems: the entanglement of trade policies, food imports, and the legacy of colonialism. Why do so many African nations import food they could grow locally? Who benefits from these arrangements and who loses? And how are modern trade regimes reproducing old patterns of dependency? To unpack this, I'm honored to be joined by Raj Patan, activist, economist, filmmaker, and author of the widely influential Stuffed and Starved in the Value of Nothing. Raj has spent decades analyzing how global systems shape our everyday lives, and his sharp critique of corporate food regimes continues to inspire movements across the global south. Welcome to the podcast, Raj.
Million, it's an honor to be here and an honor in some way to support the amazing work you're doing.
Thank you very much. Raj, before we dive into, you know, the heart of the podcast, tell us a bit about your story. What sparked your passion for food, trade, and food justice?
Well, I honestly, I've been doing this since I was five. I mean, I grew up in England, but my ancestors, well, my mother was born in Kenya, but, you know, many generations ago, my family is from India, some of my family is from India, and we were there, and it was one of my earliest memories is seeing extreme poverty in India, and I was so upset by it that the minute we got back home, I started renting out toys in kindergarten to raise money for famine relief, and I've been doing hunger work since then.
Oh, that's fantastic. Let's start at the root, Raj.
Yeah.
How did the global food trade come to be so skewed in favor of the global north? You know,
I was looking at this question, and it's such a terrific question because it lets me answer that. Yes, food trade is skewed to the global north for now, but historically, the countries in the global south have been much more powerful and much more integrated in terms of trade, right? I mean, you've got the cross Indian Ocean trade, you've got amazing trade within Africa, within Asia, within Latin America. But the reason that over the past 500 years that the global north has come to dominate is because of colonialism and capitalism. But I think it's worth just saying the global north is in charge for now, both because you can see at the moment this period of US and European decline and the rise of China and the rise of other forces in the global south. But also it reminds us that actually, you know, the global sort of center of demography and demographic and economic growth this century is going to be Africa. So we should remember that actually, you know, yes, historically the global north has been in charge because it has administered colonialism, but it doesn't always have to be that way, and it's certainly won't be that way in the future.
But can you unpack that a little bit, especially for Africa?
Well, I mean, obviously, with Europe's, really with Britain taking the lead in colonialism, the European powers also felt like they needed to compete. And so you had, you know, various European powers, you know, Italy in what was then called Abyssinia, and you had, you know, Germany in Namibia, you had Portugal all over the place. France, obviously, and then of course Britain as well, setting up things like the sort of settler colony and East Africa, and the Dutch, of course, in South Africa. So all of these colonists wanted to carve up Africa. These were all sites either for really resource extraction, or occasionally markets for some of their for their produce. But it was all part of an imperial vision, certainly for the United Kingdom, and then everyone else was catching up.
Hmm. Yeah, you know, I sometimes just confuse me. Why did we sit on our hands and wait for them to really take the power from our hands? Why? You know, that the why question is always always with me. At the end of the day, I think it will come back in order to be balanced.
Well, but I mean, to be fair, Million, I mean, people did fight back. I don't think there's a history of people sitting on their hands. I think that often these stories of colonialism erase the resistance from within Africa and, you know, the fight back. Yeah.
Okay. Can you walk us through some of the ways food importers deepen dependency, particularly in African countries?
Well, I mean, this gets to the idea that, I mean, we should be clear about what dependency is.
Yeah.
And it's both the idea that countries are not in control of their economies, that they are dependent on key imports for other countries. But it's not just that you're dependent on imports, like, for example, America is dependent on the Global South for bananas and coffee, because we don't grow those things here. But that's not dependency in the way that you mean it. The dependency is also about an asymmetry of power, of who gets to set the terms of that dependency. And that history is a history of not just colonialism, where, that in order to be able to have the goods from the global north and the technological development, countries had to abase themselves and workers had to work to supply materials for the global north. But we now have this regime of debt. And I think this is the key mechanism that we need to understand, because once a country is in debt, then all of a sudden you have everything you need in place to turn that economy into one that concentrates on agricultural exports, that doesn't allow itself to develop industrial bases or technological bases, but instead becomes the site of tropical product export so that the global north remains in charge.
Mm. I was also reading about, a situation like Haiti, and some African countries where organizations, like we said, were flooding the markets of these countries with cheap food. And the local community gets used to eat this food. The oil markets in the country will be skewed to the global north. Some countries like Ethiopia, we never had, rice is not in our diet when I was a child. But it came through aid, So dependency can come through aid too, no?
Well, I mean, and actually, Million, I was very curious about what you thought of, the recent politics around USAID. I mean, here in the United States, there's uproar that USAID has been cut, and we know that, it's certainly the case that there are going to be lives lost in Africa because of USAID. But you've had a longer experience of the problems with aid, and so, I mean, what do you think of this cutting of USAID?
I've written an article about it, which I'm going to send it out. Some people say that there are so many people in pain now because of the cutting of this aid. And maybe releasing it's not the appropriate time. But in terms of the influence that USAID has had on our policies, especially biosafety policies in the country. I was in the room in meetings where people who've been supported by USAID kind of pushing for the change in watering down our biosafety laws and regulations. And I can give you a typical example of the Comprehensive African Agriculture Development Program, CADAP. And it was obvious that, USAID was one of the forces who have influenced the outcome of that document. The Kampala Declaration was hugely influenced by USAID. So, USAID was influencing our agricultural policies, our agricultural strategies, and city strategies, and opening the way for corporate control of our food system. That's how I read it.
Me too. I mean, I think it's really interesting to see the amnesia, right? To see people forget that. I mean, so for example, in South Africa, where I've spent a lot of time and do a lot of work still, there's definitely going to be lives lost because of PEPFAR being suspended. This is the HIV/AIDS drugs
thing.
It's ridiculous. But remember that the reason PEPFAR happened in the first place is because for 10 years before PEPFAR, we had antiretroviral drugs available in the global north, but it was thousands of dollars. And the countries in the global south were saying, well, right, fine, we're going to publish this, let's make generic versions in the global south, because we can never afford what you pay in America, and let us make these drugs. And for 10 years, the US fought hard against any kind of relaxation, and millions of people died. And now USAID gives the money, and yes, it's important. People are alive because of this USAID money, but so many more people would have been alive if the US hadn't gotten involved in the first place. And I think the story of USAID makes us hostage to the idea that, to a certain forgetting of history, where USAID has always been the sort of gentle arm of violent US policy. In Zimbabwe, USAID and the CIA share the same office. I mean, it's not very well hidden. We know that these people are the same people. So yeah. We shouldn't be surprised that these aid complexes are part of an aggressive policy that comes from the donor countries.
Neocolonialism, we have a name for it.
Mm-hmm.
So. What role do institutions like the IMF, World Bank, WTO play in shaping trade rules that affect food systems in general and in Africa in particular?
Well, to understand this, we really have to look to the crisis of the 1970s, when a number of countries, particularly African countries, were leading a vision for the world that was called the New International Economic Order. It was going to be a way in which countries in the global south could have some sovereignty over their food systems and over their supply chains. But this, the New International Economic Order happened at the same time as there was an oil crisis, and then a food price crisis, then inflation and stagflation. But all of a sudden, the oil producing countries had a lot of money because they had raised the price, and no one else had a choice but to pay them. So they had a lot of dollars, and these dollars were circulating in the international economy, and it meant that borrowing rates through the 1970s were very low. And so a lot of countries in Africa borrowed money at low interest rates.
Yeah.
And then the neoliberal turn in America started under Jimmy Carter and then was continued under Ronald Reagan, of what was called the Volcker shock, which was a very high rise in the rate of interest. And all of a sudden, you have countries in the global south are unable to pay their loans, and they needed new loans to repay just the interest on the old ones. Yeah. And at this moment, the IMF and the World Bank become much more important players. Before that, actually, they were not significant players in terms of the governance of countries in the global south. But once they become the gatekeepers to your country's solvency, then what they started doing was structural adjustment plans. And this is a way, imagine if you go to the bank and ask for a loan, and the banker will say, yes, but only if I can come in your house, rearrange your furniture, tell you what you're doing, what your wife's doing, and what your children are doing. And this is exactly what the World Bank IMF did. And so they set the rules for trade. They said, well, you don't need a big government. You need to shrink your government. You need to devalue your currency. You need to have more export orientation. You need fewer controls on companies, less protection for labor and the environment. All of this so that companies can come in, get dollars, and then you will be able to repay your loans.
Exactly. Thank you very much. I think you already responded to my following question. Are there historical moments like the structural adjustment programs that laid ground for today's dependence?
Well, yeah, that's it. I mean, it is from the 1970s, but then through the 80s, you have these structural adjustment loans. And I do want to make clear, though, that sometimes, I mean, even here now, people misremember that period, because sometimes you can say, well, the bank didn't get it right, and then they had to readjust. And now if you look at the growth curves, you can see that actually, ultimately there was trickle down, and somehow, people got better off. But that's not what happened. In the 1980s, there were protests, and people demanded that, and it was people on the streets in major cities in Africa rioting against the IMF and the World Bank. And that caused the change, and that caused a more redistributive politics. It wasn't natural, it didn't come out of the air, it wasn't just trickle down. This trickle down is a useless idea, because it then deprives us of agency, of being able to pull down some of this wealth. And that's what happened.
Now they were called out,
Yeah. And you were involved in that, Million, right? Tell me about that, though.
We try to do that, you know, in so many ways. With the African Biodiversity Network, you know, we're working on protecting African seeds. I think we were part of, we're lucky to be part of a grouping where we had African giants like the Ethiopian Toldebrand of Zambia, and there was this Nigerian also, I forgot his name, and somebody from Zambia. You know, they were leaders, a global leader on the seed and biodiversity movement. When all those negotiations on CBD and the biosafety protocols did happen. So they were from the government side, but we meet quite regularly. And as part of the African Biodiversity Network, we were pushing for the rights of farmers, for the no patent laws, you know, we're against patent laws.
But then, Million, I mean, people will hear, you know, the convention on biodiversity, and that doesn't sound like it's the World Bank. So how did the World Bank make itself manifest in that problem?
You know, more and more these days, the World Bank is basically the bank of the powerful, you know, as you know. So they want to stretch their hands, you know, wherever there is money. They want to shape policies.
That's right.
The biodiversity law, the biodiversity regulations are very much tied with biosafety laws and biosafety regulations and GMOs, you know, the companies want to push genetically modified organisms into the African market. And the World Bank and IMF were their arm in doing that. You know, they were arm twisting in so many national governments. So they're very much, you know, interwoven, and they work together, as you know.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, I mean, for me, it was also very interesting to see that, you know, the World Bank would turn up in all kinds of places because these were moments where, you know, governments were saying, well, we don't want your products, particularly genetically modified crops. And you would find that the strangest kinds of regulation, you know, I mean, the US Trade Representative, even now, is fighting against. You know, the monitoring baby milk powder for contaminants, for example. They say this is a non-tariff barrier because you don't want your babies to be poisoned by things. You must just trust us, and you must trust your domestic producers. And I you know, I find it quite ridiculous to see how many places the trade representative and the bank end up.
Let's explore issues related to neo-colonialism in a policy disguise. You've written about the colonial roots of hunger. How do today's trade policies continue that colonial project?
Well, I mean, I think when we remember colonialism, we shouldn't just remember that it was like, you know, the bad guys were over there and the good guys were all in our country, because we had our own bad guys, right? You know, in the history of India, for example, if you look at the situation in contemporary India with Narendra Modi, look at who the oligarchs are in India. These are mainly, they're not all, you know, so some of the richest families are the ones who were also the ones who were ready to work with the British and be the bankers for the British in their opium wars, for example. The Tata family, you may have heard of. They're the people who own Jaguar, Land Rover, and a bunch of other companies. But they were opium bankers for the British, and you know, they made their money not by fighting British colonialism because they were Indian, but by making money from British colonialism because they were Indian. So let us remember that, because that helps us understand that. You know, when we have our own national bourgeoisie, as Frantz Fanon talked about, they're the people who are betraying working farmers and working people and working families. And that's the way that neocolonialism works, is you will have you know, some of the largest landowners and the largest sort of chiefs who have control over vast areas. And then they will license the companies to come in and produce their primary commodity crops. And there will be a buddy-buddy partnership between the bourgeoisie and this, you know, these foreign capitalists. And that neo-colonialism is very much what it looked like under old colonialism, that there would be, you know, local rajas or princes or whoever it was who was given some, you know, little slice from the pie, so that they would keep, make sure that working people were, you know, were kept quiet and indigenous people were exterminated, and all of this would happen under old colonialism and neo-colonialism. But the difference now is the weapons that are being used. Yeah. So in general, in old colonialism, you know, and again, this gets to your question of how was Africa overrun so quickly by Europeans? You know, I mean, Europeans had guns, and that kind of weaponry is really quite overwhelmingly powerful. And the weaponry that they have now is financial, because if a country wants to be able to stand on its own two feet, it needs to be able to invest. I mean, you know, what country can build hospitals without a bank lending it money? The hospital isn't going to come out of nowhere. So in this moment of borrowing, you have to borrow in something. What are you going to borrow in? You know, no country is going to trust your own currency if you just print it out. So you have to, you know, like Zimbabwe, so you have to index it to something. What do you index to? Either gold or dollars. And these days, dollars are much cheaper than gold. So then, you know, you're figuring out that this neo-colonialism is really about whose currency are you going to be strapped to? And this means that in some ways, you know, China is, I mean, you know, the terms of Chinese lending are a little better than European, but it's still hostage to debt repayment. And I think this is quite important. And I'm actually curious about how you're feeling about Chinese investments in Africa right now, because what I'm hearing is the terms are much less draconian than the World Bank. I mean, China isn't coming in and saying you should do this with your economy, but because at some level they don't have to. They you know, the infrastructure for colonial investment is already there, and China's just stepping into it. But what do you think about the Chinese investment, William?
In the countries that they were managed very well, I don't know the details, to be honest with you, but from the little information that they have in Ethiopia, for example, they really changed the infrastructure in Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. They upgraded a lot of infrastructures. They opened a lot of factories in whatever. So, yeah, I mean, there is always some things here and there, but then grossly, it's good. But there are some countries who didn't manage it very well, where they came into the local trade and local market. It can easily corrupt you, you know. It's very easy for them to do that. And back home, there is no government who say that, oh, you are doing this, you're bad. You know, there is not that. It's not like that. So there's no accountability to some extent. So in some countries, it didn't work out very well. In some countries, it really worked out very well.
Mm.
You know? So it all depends on whether the country that they operate in has a good governance structure, at least semblance of good. You go to DRC, for example, they own this big extractive unit there. Even the minister of the country sometimes cannot go there even. So these are scenarios. So it's different. Lots of shades of gray, you know?
Yeah, it's complicated. I mean, you're right.
No. Yeah. So, how do you respond to the arguments that importers simply fill gaps or boost consumer choices?
Explain this argument a little bit to me, because I'm more confused when I hear it.
Imports create dependency. There are some countries like in Africa, in Central Africa, there are some countries, Gabon, for example, 70 to 80% of Gabon's food is imported from outside. And the figure is different in different countries, but it is still high, so many African countries. So when you criticize this, now, because, you know, this food is coming because there's gap in the production of that food in that particular country. So it's filling this gap. What do you say about this kind of argument?
I mean, why is there a gap in the first place? And secondly, you know, what kind of a gap is it? I mean, you know, do you want the food that we have here in the United States, for example? I would say that you don't, because there was a recent study funded by the Rockefeller Foundation about the American diet. And it turns out that for every dollar we spend on food in the United States, we spend an additional dollar on healthcare just for diet-related disease. And then of that, yeah, and so, and then on top of that, there's additional like environmental, ecological, and worker externalities. So essentially, for every dollar we spend on the food system, we spend $2 extra on other costs, one of which is healthcare. So are we saying, well, you know, what's really missing in Africa is food that makes you sick? Because then, I think we could probably do without that. But I hear this argument in a different way as well, which is here in the global north, people will say, well, look, if we don't buy their bananas and chocolate, what are they going to do? You know, the workers there are asking for money, and I mean, at some level, there's an interesting question here, which is, you know, if you have small-scale agroecological coffee or chocolate production, and you know these things are possible, then by not buying those things, you're removing the main cash crop for this market, and isn't that a bad thing? And you know, my response is, well, look, you're saying that your demand has created this huge infrastructure of cocoa and banana production. And now you're saying, well, and all you owe people is not to consume that? No, that's bad mathematics. What you owe is the history of colonialism. That's what you owe. You don't really owe that you stop eating bananas and it feels like a privation for you in the global north. You owe reparations. And I think that question of reparations is one that hasn't really been spoken about, obviously not under the Trump administration. They'll never talk about that. But I mean, the fact is the global north owes the global south. It's only through a recognition that the global north owes the global south that we will ever have this kind of flip of an understanding of, you know, it's not just that people should grow bananas for us in the global north, but it's also we need to have a conversation about land reform and, you know, the way that land is structured under neocolonialism is large amounts of land or, you know, small farmers growing a monoculture because they have no choice. Now, under a different kind of administration with funding to transition from monoculture into something else, we could imagine lots of different things. We could imagine a food system where you didn't have to import, 80% of your food because you weren't exporting, you weren't using the land for growing bullshit crops, and instead you were growing things that actually mattered for your local economy.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, Export is a very, very interesting thing. And it's a very complex thing, as you know. Why do we focus on export crops? You know, and what's the impact of that? It's market-led agriculture is one of the push by the Green Revolution, of the Green Revolution agenda, as you know. So, I mean, it destroys biodiversity because the focus is on a few crops. And to grow those crops, what methodology do you use? You know, do you use your own agroecological method, or do you inherit other methods of production? When you inherit, it means the usage of a lot of agrochemicals. And what we are talking about is hidden costs would come there. You know, health costs, environmental costs, a lot of things would come. I think the focus, I mean, that's my next question is related to food sovereignty. You know, when food becomes a commodity, then the problem starts from there. Are you feeding your own people with the land that you have, or are you feeding people outside of your country? That's what exports, you know. So food sovereignty, what does real food sovereignty look like for you? I know that we have written quite a lot about food sovereignty. I think one time I read something that you said, that I usually use, like a phrase, even a prisoner is food secure. That's what you say. I use that phrase quite a lot of times. So, what's food sovereignty for you, and how do you relate food sovereignty to the fight against neocolonialism.
So let's start with food security. So you mentioned this term, and food security is that you've got access to sufficient and nutritious food to lead a healthy and active life. But as long as you have access to it, that's all that is demanded for the condition of food security. So that's why, you know, I say, well, you can be food secure in prison. You know, if you're getting 3 meals a day, you have access to enough food to live a healthy and, you know, a healthy life. I mean, your conditions may suck, but you're food secure. So to be food sovereign is to be able to have power to decide how your food system looks.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so the way that food sovereignty looks to me, to answer your question, is lots of democratic conflict. Because, you know, in the food system itself, we have systems that are very, you know, power, that have very unequal power relations. You know, you have people in the city buying from people in the country. So who gets to decide? Is it the people in the city who decide what happens to me, or the people in the country who decide what happens to the people in the city? We need to be able to figure that out. And the way to do that is through democratic conflict. But also, you know, we talk a lot about celebrating family farms, but we also know that families, you know, families are a zone of extreme patriarchy. You know, must we also celebrate women's oppression in order to have a family farm? Well, no. So we must have an idea of conflict, even within the home, that is healthy and that leads towards equality. Because otherwise, you know, we're not really talking about food sovereignty. We're talking about, you know, we'll have some food sovereignty here, but we'll have domination over here, and that's fine. So, you know, and this is what I love about La Via Campesina's invention of the idea of food sovereignty. You know, initially they invented it in 1995, well, a little bit before that, but it announced it in 95 at the World Food Summit in Rome. And they said, look, we don't want food security. Food security is what your neoliberal people are saying, you know, don't worry your little head about how all this happens. As long as there is food, if it comes off the ship from America, wherever it is, don't worry. As long as you have access, everything's fine. And La Via Campesina said, no, what we want is power. And we want power over the food system to stop you guys dumping your, you know, your goods below the cost of production and wiping out our farmers. But one of the things about La Via Campesina is that it is a permanent and very painstaking democratic process. So in 95, what they were saying is, well, the food sovereignty really means that you don't dump your agricultural products on us. And, you know, they were thinking in from Mexico about US dumping corn at below the cost of production in the Mexican market and destroying the livelihoods of Mexican farmers. Mm-hmm. But after, you know, 5-10 years, what La Via Campesina said was actually, no, food sovereignty is also about an end to violence against women. And, you know, they say that because food sovereignty means equality, not just in terms of democratic decision making at the national level, but also in the home. And again, this shows what food sovereignty is about. It's not just about are you eating. It's about how we distribute power in a way that is equitable. So that's what food sovereignty looks like to me.
Now, in most African countries, you know, you hear governments talk about food sovereignty. Even the African Development Bank talks about food sovereignty, and that means producing your own agrochemicals, basically.
No, but you know, what words do we have that they haven't tried to steal? I mean, you know, when we were talking about organic agriculture, then they're like, fine, we'll do monocultures of organic agriculture. And, you know, and agroecology, well, you know, they've tried to subvert that by using things like regenerative agriculture. And they're not talking about labor, really. They're just talking about, you know, just making extraction a little less extractive. So, you know, I think this is a sign that we're doing well, that our language of sovereignty is making it into places. But what we have to do now is defend it and move away from, as you say, this ridiculous position that food sovereignty is about being able to make your agriculture. Or, you know, in Europe, the French are saying food sovereignty is so we can use the French military to protect our supply chains. In Italy, they're saying food sovereignty is we can kick out brown people and their, because we must have pure Italian food, whatever that means. Yeah. You know, I mean, there's this language can be very dangerous. but it's also, I mean, when you're seeing food sovereignty and, you know, African, you know, the development banks and the agencies using food sovereignty, how do you think about pushing back? How do we reclaim this idea?
We have actually analyzed the document that they produced.
Mm.
Really analyzed it. You know, they produced compacts. These are compacts are agreements with 40 African countries. And they have said that they've raised more than $60 billion to support the compact. Now they are talking about merging these compacts with the CADAP plan of action, the Kampala plan of action that they call it. So we analyzed it and we found out that actually it erodes our seed sovereignty. Because they are talking about, you know, improving your seeds and its patents and whatever. And it actually exacerbates the land situation for our farmers. Because inviting so many businesses from outside to farm in Africa. It means, you know, producing a high number of agrochemicals and, you know, artificial fertilizers and pesticides. And that would mean, you know, that what that would mean, you know, they just pushing the farmers into a pot, you know, which is difficult to excrete themselves out of it. So, yeah. So gender, when they talk about gender, oh, if women could get access to credit, they should be fine. You know? Money. In, you know, Africa exporting its non-food to outside, you know, that is export-oriented. So it's a green revolution agenda called food sovereignty, basically.
But we should talk about this green revolution. I mean, I think people forget that the green revolution was always a political intervention to keep things the same in rural areas, or rather to favor large-scale farmers in rural areas so that people in the cities wouldn't rise up. You know, if you look at the origins of the phrase the Green Revolution, it comes from the head of USAID in 1968, a man called William Goud. And he said, you know, he was talking about the Green Revolution. He was in a Senate hearing where the senators were saying, well, you know, we understand what the Green Revolution is. It's sort of a package of technology plus, you know, the subsidies that you need to pay farmers in order to be able to adopt these things. You know, again, the Green Revolution wasn't just about seeds. It was about a whole structure of economic policy. And he said, yeah, that's right. You know, but the reason we're doing this is because it's not a red revolution like that of the Soviets, and it's not a white revolution like that of the Shah of Iran. It's the Green Revolution. And the idea of the Green Revolution was to make sure that people didn't go communist, that people in cities were not going to rise up and demand radical change. And so if you make cheap food available to the people in the cities, they won't worry too much about the fact that life's pretty shitty, as long as they can eat. So, yeah, I mean, I just wanted to sort of fill that part into our discussion, because you're saying the Green Revolution, and I think people sometimes think the Green Revolution is just about seeds and about some corporations making money from the seeds. But in fact, it's much bigger than that. It's certainly about companies making money from seeds, but it's also about stabilizing relations of power in a way that's very unequal, but allowing enough cheap food to be available so that those relationships are not questioned.
Yeah. Raj, from your experience, what are the most effective ways of pushing against these trade regimes, you know? And how can movements of movements like AFSA can push back against this, you know, draconian trade regimes?
Well, I mean, I think you need a sort of twin approach. One is to develop the alternatives that you want to see, right? I mean, there's no point, if tomorrow the draconian trade regime ends and we have no practice at being able to do the alternative, then we're in trouble. So I definitely think that half of the problem is, and again, AFSA's already doing this through, you know, in many different places, figuring out what an agroecological future would look like, practicing some of the policies of public supply chains, making sure that we have the expertise and the knowledge to be able to enter government. But the other side is absolutely a more aggressive and resistive stance against these policies. And you're seeing some signs of that. You know, in India, for example, at the World Trade Organization, is increasingly aggressive and at saying, well, no, actually, we need domestic supplies in case there's, you know, a climate emergency, in case there's another food price spike. And so we're developing our own domestic policy, and we don't care what the WTO does. You know, go screw yourself. And I think that's quite important, right? That you have a government intervention that is strong, yeah, that is powerful, that is also resisting. And, you know, to make the government do that is difficult. But, you know, this is work that you and I have been involved in for some time. I was a part of a group called Seyatini under the great Yash Tandon in Harare, where we were working.
No.
Yeah.
Seyatini in Uganda, yeah.
Yeah. you know, and it was a fantastic, I mean, it is a fantastic organization, right? The Southern East African Trade Information Negotiations Initiative. We were training civil servants to fight back against, you know, European and US trade law. And it's important to be able to do that, to have governments stand up for the rights of Africans. So yeah. I think you need both of these things. We definitely need the alternatives, and we need the government to pay for them. But we also need the government to stand up against this crap, because, you know, otherwise we have no choice. So I think it's a dual sort of approach of, you know, entering government, being powerful within government, making government do what we want, but also developing these alternatives ourselves.
Yeah. Would AFA response also, you know, what role does agroecology play in challenging trade-driven food dependence?
Again, it depends what you mean by agroecology. And sometimes we have to fight to remember that agroecology is not just a technique of growing food, right? I mean, often we're you know, the shorthand that people think about when they think about agroecology is that it's polyculture as opposed to monoculture, and that you're just producing inputs and using maybe local seed, maybe not, doesn't matter. But it's, you know, that you're more dependent, you're less dependent on other people on farm. But I don't like that, and it's not actually part of even the loosest definition the FAO has, involves a circular and solidarity economy as part of agroecology. And people often forget that actually, you know, people don't eat everything that's grown on farm. You need a market to sell your product to. And the journey that the food takes from the market and the journey the money takes back is actually part of the story of agroecology, and it's often forgotten. And I'm really curious about this in the context where you've been really involved in agroecological research. How much, you know, engagement with the sort of broader ideas of territorial markets do you hear from people who are involved in the agroecological side of things?
Not that much. You know, this supermarketization of our trade system is very much powerful. People see supermarkets as a sign of growth, kind of development. But interestingly, I had a very interesting discussion with the East African community parliamentarians. So we're talking about, you know, territorial markets. And a Kenyan lawmaker said that the Kenyan government has actually started to upgrade these small territorial markets all over Kenya. And they are facing some challenges, you know, when they do that. In some of these markets, people don't use them. You know, they build them, they upgrade them, people build. But that's another kind of problem. But there is a focus now, increasingly, on these small territorial markets, and we are pushing for a particular kind of law to support these small markets in Africa. And we are trying to tie it up with this African Continental Free Trade Area Agreement, you know. So we are trying to do that, but the level of understanding needs a lot of improvement. But people know the value of this market. There are cultural places, social places, economic spaces also. So yeah, they do.
But I mean, I take your point, though, Milian, that supermarkets do feel like progress compared to an open air market. I mean, you know, they've got air conditioning, they've got, you know, machines, they've got electricity. But I think it's interesting that part of this circular economy story has also to involve public purchasing and public supply chains. Part of the supermarketization process is about owning what used to be public infrastructure, right? You know, to be able to take a public port and make it private, or to, you know, use shipping facilities, or just to steal, you know, the rights to the road to be able to then do whatever it is you want to do. This is a privatization of public infrastructure. And one of the examples I'm very excited about that we're following, you and I, in IPES, is in the Indian state of Andhra Pradesh, where, you know, it's 40 million people, about 6 million farmers, 1 million of whom are already doing agroecology. In this area, they're not just interested in teaching farmers how to grow polycultures, although that's definitely part of the story, but they're interested in figuring out, well, look, can we get the government to buy agroecological food for school meals, for example, or for hospitals, or for the local clinic? This public, the idea that
procurement is a public procurement,
and then the public owns the supply chain between the, you know, the farm, is, I think that's quite important. So it's not just agroecology on the farm; you have to have agroecology off farm as well.
Yeah, actually, we are starting research on participatory research on public. For public procurement of agroecological products, you know. Are they doing it? If they are not doing it, why are they not doing it? What will the impact of procuring agroecological products on the farmers also?
Yeah.
Because basically, if they get the market, they will produce it, you see? So they may have so many elements, environmental, health benefits. So this is one of the areas that we are exploring as AFSA.
Fantastic. If people want to find out more about, we should say that a territorial market is just, you know, a market where that it's sort of not a globalized market, but in fact can range from, you know, the local village to, you know, a region. But these ideas are really taking off around the world. We've just finished some research looking at school lunches in particular for the upcoming IPES report on labor. But there are really interesting supply chain laws, like in Brazil, that require 30% of food served in schools to be agroecological and local rather, and then there's an agroecological bonus of 30%. So these laws can make a real difference.
Yeah, I agree with you. The Brazilian example is very much excellent. We're finalizing RISE in this fantastic discussion. If you could reimagine global trade rules from the ground up, where would you begin?
Well, the great joy of my reimagining all of that is that I wouldn't be in charge. I think, you know, I mean, in part, right, I would begin with reparations. I think that... you know, we're in the era of catastrophic climate change. You know, we're in an era where, you know, the majority of Pakistan was flooded, a few years back. And it's just ridiculous that we can pretend that we're still living in the 20th century with our trade arrangements. So we need to rethink and, you know, repay from the global north to the global south. But that injection of money offers a way of engaging in farming that is much more sequestering of carbon, that is more sort of local centric, but is also capable of exchange, but of an exchange that is non-exploitative. And that does mean, yeah, I mean, America will never grow coffee or bananas or cocoa. It's just, you know, we don't have the climate for it. But if countries in the global south choose that they would like to set aside this amount of their land, but no more, for coffee, and then reap extreme rewards because we have a very inelastic demand here. That would be terrific. But that's what a sort of food sovereign approach would look like. It would be in the framework of a new international economic order that doesn't look like a predatory one, and the one that the past 500 years have been characterized by.
Do you think the disruption that this president is causing would lead into that somehow?
Well, I certainly think that we're at the end of American hegemony. And I think that this is good and bad, right? I mean, it's because we had a previous period like this where at the end of the First World War, Britain had come to the end of its colonial era of hegemony. And there was a big pandemic, and then there was a huge period of debt. And it all looks very familiar, right? We had the Spanish flu, millions of people died, and then Britain couldn't repay its war debts. Britain and its greatest rival, America, were in very tense relationships. America had plans to invade Britain and Canada. This is called War Plan Red, right? This feels very much like the time we're in at the moment. And it was conceivable, even as late as 1928, that the US and the UK would have gone to war. In the end, the war was with the fascists in Germany, and that was still catastrophic, right? It ended with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was horrible. Yes, the end of American hegemony is a good idea, but what comes next may not be great. And this is what history teaches us, that we could be entering an era of fascism. We could be entering an era of Chinese quasi-socialism. Maybe we want that more than we want American hegemony, but maybe there's something still better that we could fight for. But I do think we're coming to the end of this period of US dominance. And this is what the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci called the interregnum, this period where the old institutions have died, but the working class has not yet mastered the tools of government. And so until we do that, until we have that mastery, I think we're in very dangerous times.
We'll have a separate discussion about the artificial intelligence role into all this chaos. that would be another discussion, yeah.
It will. I do think, if we're just looking for moments of hope, then I think, no matter what comes next, agroecology is going to be quite important in the story, because it is either, a sort of survival strategy, or it's a pattern for imagining how the world could be substantially better.
Yeah, no, totally agree. Thanks so much, Raj, but the final message for youngsters, African young thinkers, farmers, navigating this complex system that you're heavily describing. Any advice? Yeah.
Well, I mean, the advice, of course, is to support you, Mignon, and to join in the movement to make agroecology ascendant. But this means this does mean not just planting things in a different way or shopping differently. I mean, this is about activism. This is about organizing and militancy. And it's going to feel uncomfortable, and particularly if you've not done it before, and particularly for young people, there's always going to be a first time where you go on your first protest. So go with people who have done it before. Go with a movement. Go with an organization. Don't just do it by yourself. Turn up, but turn up strong and militant and unafraid. We're all afraid on the when the police are shooting at you, you're always afraid, and it's wise to be afraid. But be bold and brave in knowing that you're fighting for something that matters, and fight together, not apart.
Thank you so much. This was excellent. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mignon, for all the work that you do. It's such an inspiration.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Mignon, thank you.